Welcome to Town Square. I'm Neil Milner, sitting in for Beth Ann Kozlovich. Every 7.5 seconds, someone in the U.S. is a victim of abuse by a current or former spouse or by a domestic partner or by a family member. In the past 12 months, we've had 5 deaths in Hawaii that were domestic violence related. On a typical day, Hawaii agencies serve over 500 victims of domestic violence. Over the past 25 years, governments, organizations, and individuals have become much more involved with combating this violence problem. Today we have 3 guests. Each of today's guests has dealt with this issue as part of his work, and each will participate in the 21st Annual Men's March Against Violence in Hawaii, which takes place next week, Thursday, October 8th at noon at the state capitol. Today we'll talk about that march, our guests' experience in the domestic violence field, and what the responses to domestic violence look like, especially in Hawaii. Our guests are Jairus Hedges, the dean of the John A. Burns Medical School at the University of Hawaii. He's also a former emergency medicine physician, and he was the honorary chair of the 2014 Men's March. Salvatore Lanzalotti is a special assistant to the Kapi'olani Community College Chancellor. He was formerly head of Oahu's Department of Emergency Services and its Department of Community Services, and he's an original co-founder of the march back 21 years ago. Peter Mattoon is a caseworker at Catholic Charities Hawaii and a program supervisor for its housing placement services, which deals with the abuse a lot. Peter is also one of the Men's March organizers. Remember, the number to call is 941-3689. Neighbor Islands is 877-941-3689. We encourage you to call with questions or comments or with your own experiences with domestic violence. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you.
Aloha.
Aloha. Let me start with this question. Sal, why is it a men's march? I noticed that you encourage other people to participate, but the march has always been a men's march. Why?
Well, it started about 21 years ago, and a gentleman by the name of Joe Bloom from Catholic Charities was in a meeting with a group of women, and they were talking about getting ready for October, which is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And one of the women said, well, Joe, what are you guys going to do? And, of course, Joe thought about that and came up with the idea of having a march. And so he talked it over with Nancy Creedman, who is the CEO of Domestic Violence Action Center. And Nancy and I knew each other from the Honolulu Commission on the Status of Women. And I had been a liaison for Mayor Frank Fossey to that. And so she knew me, and she asked me if I'd be interested, and I said absolutely. And together we met and started doing something. And the idea was that we need, you know, women obviously have been talking about this, but we needed men to stand up. And of course, the research shows, if you look at research on binge drinking and alcohol use and drugs and all that, the way to stop people from doing things is through their peers. And so how do we address men if not by men? And how do we pass on a culture of peace if not by men to other men? So we emphasized that it was a men's march from the very beginning.
What was the first one like?
First one was absolutely wonderful. We started out actually at the state capitol and walked around a little bit, and actually, we started out at, I think, at Ke Kauliki, and we walked down King Street, maybe about 150 people, and to the Capitol, where the Korean memorial is. And it was absolutely wonderful. I've got pictures of that, and I remember Mayor Harris. I remember... Oh, a bunch of politician types, and of course, the rest of us.
So for the other two, how did you get involved with it?
Let me say, Neil, that I've been honored to be a part of the advisory board for Catholic Charities, and Jerry Rockhorst had said it'd be great for you to be involved in this event. My background as an emergency physician gave me some perspective that I felt that was an important thing. And, of course, it's a really key issue on campuses across the U.S. And here in Hawaii, at the University of Hawaii, we're working very hard around Title IX issues and addressing violence not only on campus but also at home that may come into the workplace. So this is a big issue for the University of Hawaii.
Peter?
I've been an employee of Catholic Charities for 10 years now, so we've always been a part of it. Everybody from the agency pitches in and helps out, and I definitely feel very strongly about the cause. I was brought up in a family that my dad's a retired psychologist. It was all about behavioral modification as opposed to, you know, intimidation and that type of thing. So I felt very strongly about it, and a few years ago I had an opportunity to join the steering committee and actually affect it even more. So that's when I joined the actual committee.
So I noticed, Jerris, you mentioned Title IX, and it seems as if the government is, well, we're changing the kinds of ways that we see domestic violence and violence and abuse. It seems to be becoming more encompassing or more interconnected. Is that affecting the way that you're thinking about the march now? Has the march changed at all in regard to what you're trying to do there?
Well, Sal can give some of the longitudinal perspective, but I just like to jump in and say that one of our challenges in society is that we tend not to talk about violence in the home. It tends to be something we retain as a personal issue, and it's hard to get people to speak up. So the march has always been not only about the peer pressure, but making people in general aware that this is an issue and that there are options for people, that they do not have to persevere, but there are options out of that situation. So Title IX is a federal effort to bring attention to this, but it's something that groups like Catholic Charities Domestic Violence Action Center have been doing for some time now.
Yeah, I think also in the beginning, you know, we started out, as I said, it was a men's march. But as we have gone along, we've been trying to spread the word and broaden the awareness of exactly what the problem is. And that means many more social service agencies, but also going after, especially in the last few years, we've been going after businesses and trying to get them involved, banks. You'll notice that some of our sponsors are corporations, because I think the numbers are across the country, $5 to $8 billion a year is wasted because of domestic violence, interpersonal issues. $1.8 billion a year in direct medical costs across this country related to domestic violence injuries. Businesses lose productivity because women come in late, leave early, miss work. So the issue is obviously much broader than everyone has talked about. And as you said, Jerris, it's like a silent epidemic, it's been called. And so the more awareness we get out there, the better we are.
Remember, the phone number to call for questions, comments, or your own personal experiences is 941-3689 on Oahu or Neighbor Islands, 1-877-941-3689. You know, it strikes me that this is a form of community organizing. And there are different ways that community organizing works, but one of the things that community organizers try to do is to take a next step, that you start with a march, or you start with a rally, or you start with a protest, and then you build on that. Is there that kind of building going on?
Well, we have started doing some things, like there was a strategic initiative a couple of years ago that we tried in terms of violence in general, workplace violence. Everybody has a policy, but many places don't have a policy that covers domestic violence. So that women, I think the percentage is about 20% of the women who lose their jobs because of who are in these relationships lose their jobs because of domestic violence, because the boss doesn't want, is afraid it's going to come to the corporation or to the business site. And so the person loses their job. And so we have been working with, trying to work with corporations locally to get them to put a domestic violence clause in there to protect women. And I think now we have had some law changes so that now that's illegal to fire somebody because they have that, you know, that kind of an issue. So, yes, there are those kinds of next steps. And again, I think the next steps have been for us directly to get more and more people involved and more awareness of the problem.
As Sal says, the most recent focus has been on how to work with businesses and make them not only aware but prepared when there are instances that come up in the workplace so they don't lose a worker. But we have for some time had programs that network health providers, in particular hospitals with social workers and with shelters, so that there's an actual continuum of potential support for the person who will come forward.
And to build on that continuum, back in, I think, 1999, I brought this issue to, at the time I was in director of EMS, and emergency services, and EMS was in my department, and I brought it to our paramedics, and I got some resistance because they felt it was a social service agency, a social service issue. And so I backed off. And I then started reading all the literature from emergency physicians, from nursing, from EMS, and I put together a questionnaire, which I sent out to 100 cities that were the same size, around the same size as Honolulu, and asked them, what are your protocols? Do you do this? Do you do this? Because I took those protocols out of from the literature. And I found that although like 70% said, yeah, there should be protocols to deal with domestic violence issues, the same percentage said, no, we don't have them. And so, I really apologize to Pat, one of the paramedics. She and I got together afterwards, and she put together the protocols based on these, the best practices. And then we instituted them at city and county. We trained our personnel. And the idea was that when you got on a call, you could then document if the injury was connected to domestic violence.
So these are the paramedics, the EMTs, the ambulance drivers,
right? That's what we did. I don't know if they still do it.
Okay.
But they were instituted back in 99, 2000.
Say a little bit more about that resistance, because one of the things that we have to talk about here is not just the steps forward, but the obstacles and the difficulties and the challenges that still exist. Can you say a little bit more about the protocol and what you were trying to do?
Well,
and,
yes,
and
because
the problem was.
One of the problems is a woman goes to get a TRO.
That's
personally,
a restraining
and
order.
And is there any history? Is there any history? Do you have any proof that this person's been beating you? Well, usually there isn't one because they're finally this is the first time after maybe a series of beatings that they're going to come forward. However, if on a medical record you have had documented, then you have legal proof. And what we did was we had it where you asked every question,
no.
Injury that was not a automobile accident, they had to ask, was this by someone who is a partner, is it this or that? And they had to, you know, and first they tried to get the male who was in the house away, or they'd have to wait until they got in the ambulance. But then they asked a question. And if the person said yes, they documented it. If they said no, but if the history, the injuries presented were not coordinated with the history, so somebody would say, no, I fell down the steps. But the paramedic sees, no, this is a defensive wound. That's why the arm is broken. And so they would mark that. And so then it was on record.
I want to come back to that a little while, especially in regard to the emergency services. We have a call from Bill from the Big Island. Bill, go ahead.
Hi. I had a comment about the amount of rewards for the mere accusation of domestic violence, including custody, child support, and divorce issues, and the basic cancellation of parental rights on mere accusation, not to mention the financial rewards, particularly in divorce.
Sure, go ahead. Make the comment.
Okay, well, that's just it. The mere accusation is like the scarlet letter of divorce proceedings, and you make that accusation, you automatically get custody of the children and child support, and a temporary restraining order can be gotten with the mere ex parte hearing in which the accused isn't even present. You know, the number of rewards, both as far as legal advantage and money and custody of the children.
Okay, Bill.
All you got to do is make that accusation an ex parte. You can get it all.
Let's have the guests comment on that if they wish. Thanks for the call. Peter?
What?
Well, this is Jarris. I'll just say that obviously one can raise the issue, and it's the society's obligation to provide protective resources for the person who has stated they're a victim. But all of these issues have to be sorted out from a legal perspective. Our most important thing is to provide protection and assume that someone's at risk until proven otherwise. The other great thing about Catholic Charities and some of the other organizations is they look at this as an issue involving a unit. You know, how do we help this family? This is a family in trouble. And sometimes support for the male, if they're the person who's perpetrating this, can be provided as part of the entire support system. So I think every situation has to be looked at individually. Each family has unique situations, and the approach to helping that family is individual. But we have to be sure that we don't leave people in a situation where they're at risk, because obviously injuries and death can happen if there's an abusive situation.
Peter, have you been involved in some of the advocacy work or with the agencies that do the advocacy?
Actually, more so for the end of folks coming in for assistance. And
yes.
Speaking to what Dr. Hedges mentioned, there are legal matters that need to be sorted out and confirmed, you know, actual incidents and whatnot. But for us at Catholic Charities on the intake department, when folks are calling for assistance, housing, financial, and they claim this is what their issue was, you know, it's a domestic violence issue, you know, we don't start with the assumption that they're lying. I mean, we start with the assumption that they need help. And so we're going to try to address that. However, certain fundings do depend on that type of documentation, like Sal was mentioning. So if we have some type of a police report or something and that can confirm that this had happened. I apologize for kind of staggering when you called my name the first time through. I don't want to go too far into this, but I've experienced very similar situations to what the caller was, I think, alluding to.
You mean personally?
Okay. And to protect others involved, I don't want to go, you know, too far into it, but there is a chain of events that happen. I mean, a TRO can be put in and you know, assumptions can fly back and forth, and it can very directly affect very important issues like custody of children and whatnot. So I hear the importance of what this person's comment is, and but it has to be fleshed out, you know, through the legal system and I guess determined exactly what did transpire.
And the legal system generally is family court.
Yes.
Yes. We have another call from Michelle in Kaneohe. Go ahead, Michelle.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Okay, this whole issue about domestic violence and handling it through the court, well, we just had another case of a guy basically getting away with it. Ex-cop, sentenced to 4 years probation. He has a chance to have his record expunged. He stalked his ex-wife or ex-girlfriend, threatened her with a service revolver, beat her numerous times, basically terrorized this woman for years, and he's facing no prison time. And it seems like, it just seems like constantly we women are being told, yes, the courts will protect us, and it doesn't happen.
Thank you, Michelle.
So, you know, that's just my comment, and I can listen to you guys off air from now on.
Thanks. I think also he gets his record expunged if he's a good boy for the next 4 years. Anybody want to comment on that?
Well, You know, we just heard two different people talk about the possible abuse of the issue. I don't know the facts, but obviously the way they presented it, there's abuse on both sides. But that's not why we're here, because the reality, as I said earlier, is that there is this issue, this silent epidemic. The reality is that 37% of all women who seek care in hospital emergency rooms for violence, for violent-related injuries, were injured by current or former spouse, boyfriend, or girlfriend. The reality is that DV is the domestic violence is the leading cause of injury to women between the ages of 15 and 44, more common than automobile accidents, muggings, and cancer deaths combined. And that's from the Surgeon General study. So if we cannot, I mean, there are peripheral issues, but the basis that we're talking about here is that this is a reality. It is a fact.
But it strikes me if you take these two calls, yes, and just see them as, yes, kind of very different, it gives people the idea of how difficult this work is for, yes, practitioners. Now, you're at an everyday level, you're much more involved with it, I think, than anything else. You want to say something about that? Can you talk? I know you didn't want to talk about that particular case. Can you just give an example, a hypothetical example, of what it's like in a common case? I don't even want to say typical, okay, with all of, not just the step one, step two, step three, but the emotions that are involved, the things you have to do.
Sure, sure. This is Peter with Catholic Charities. I run the Housing Placement Services Program, and specifically my program deals with homeless families that have minor children. And on a regular basis, going back to the effects of domestic violence, like we've talked about the deaths and the physical injuries, but there's a lot more than that involved. In my case, I see a lot of families going homeless because of it. We recently had someone contact our agency who had just moved from an out-of-state area, and specifically because we're across the ocean, and she and her kids are safer here because it's harder for the person, okay, to get over here. So, but now that person, now she's homeless with her family in a very tough market to find housing. So there's another effect of domestic violence. So we're dealing with this almost on a daily basis. We get calls like this, as well as calls from folks who have experienced domestic violence locally. They're calling from domestic violence shelters. Again, my program deals mainly with homeless families, and that's one of the reasons why some of these families are homeless.
In fact, I was looking up some stats. 57% of the homeless families identified violence as a primary cause of homelessness.
Thank you.
But what's the first encounter like? What's the first thing that generally happens when you get a call? That first, really, literally from the first. I want to ask you actually the same question from the emergency medicine standpoint, Jairus, but...
Well, I'll start with one of the more dramatic cases. We used to have our offices down on 250 Vineyard Street near Queens, and I had a woman literally run into our intake department hysterical and saying that she's being abused by her husband. Sat her down in the interview room. 5 minutes into our interview, I hear the door open. I could feel it. I could feel the tension. He was following her in. So something as dramatic as that and as severe as that at the moment, where we have to, you know, go into 911 mode and have to deal with that. So that's one of the types of, you know, first meets that we have. Mm-hmm. But we also have folks that call over the phone. And you know, at that point, the first thing we say is, are you safe to talk? You know, we want to assure that moment before we go any further. And other cases, as I mentioned, are such that maybe an advocate will call us first and say, you know, I'm working with someone here at the shelter. This is their situation. Do you think you can work with them? And mainly cases like that, they're not really comfortable to talk to us yet, you know.
Give us a call at 941-3689 on Oahu, and the neighbor islands is 1-877-941-3689. I want to remind you before we go on about the Men's March Against Violence one more time. It's next Thursday, a week from today at noon at the state capitol, and then there will be a short march over to Skygate, and there'll be a rally with some speakers. You can get more information. You're welcome to come. You don't have to sign up or anything. There's the number to call if you want more information. It's 527-4810 or mensmarchagainstviolence.everbright.com. Jairus, can you say something about what it's like in an emergency room when you're dealing with, let's say, violence?
Sure. So one of the things that Peter said that was really key, and it ties into Sal's guidance for emergency medical personnel, and that is, does the individual feel safe? And that's one of the key questions that we train all of our medical students to ask women as they present to the emergency department, is if they feel safe in their home situation, because it's a very important screening mechanism. Now, as a provider of emergency care, it's uncommon to see the person with massive trauma. More commonly, we see people who have received some injuries that are attributed to some unusual sort of accident, falling downstairs, running into the car, things that just don't quite compute. With the injury, in the mechanism of the injury and what we see doesn't quite compute. Sometimes there's no visible injuries, but there was trauma. You don't always develop a bruise on the exterior of the body immediately after an injury. But some of the other telltale signs when we see an individual who's a victim of abuse is that they will present and be unusually quiet. They will not be initiating conversation. And they will often really encourage us not to bring someone who may have accompanied them or may have arrived in the emergency department. They would rather they not be brought back to where they're being evaluated. And they're often ashamed or frightened to tell about what happened, and they're hoping that we can simply by examining them determine that they're a victim of abuse and make appropriate referral. So we have to reach out. We have to recognize when things don't quite fit, ask them the question of safety, and then encourage them to speak up, letting them know that this is a safe place to talk. And I'll stop there.
I was going to say, I want to get back to the idea of how medicine changed in its view of domestic violence in a minute, but let's take a call first. This is a call from the Big Island. Hi, welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So I'm pretty much just calling to thank you guys for the work that you do. I know my experience only from the state of Hawaii, but I know it's a work in progress because I was actually abused, accused by the abuser in regards to my children, went through the courts, and actually it's the children who are also victimized. And like I say, the courts work on that now more thoroughly, I know. So it's a work in progress, and I really appreciate what you guys are doing because the trust, it seems as though you're mentioning trust with the victim, because the victims usually, they actually love this person who might be abusing, but may also be victim themselves or in a cycle they don't understand. And, you know, so, certainly no one understands everything. But I do, again, want to thank you, gentlemen, for the work you do.
Can I ask you just one question? If you had to say overall what your experience was like, what would you say?
I'm sorry, say that again?
If you had to assess now, you said it was a work in progress. Your experience with the legal system overall in this, what would you say? How would you assess it?
Well, you know, my experience, my youngest is just turned 28. You know, and I mean, we work together. We have a farm here together. And I think that it was just like we endured and overcame on our own. But I believe that the legal system is better now because they are, you know, like if you have one, like you had a previous caller mentioned, you know, well, the accusation will separate you from your children. And as a female, I also have experience, even though previously I had, you know, actually experienced physical abuse. So I'm seeing that now, and I believe I've heard information that now, you know, in the year 2015, the legal system isn't going to just take one word against the other. You know, the priority are the children, I think it's important, like I said, what you guys do, because you're establishing trust. You know,
hi. Sorry, your connection is starting to break up. Thanks, though. I really appreciate this, and we'll talk some more about the legal system a little bit later in the show. Thank you again for calling. Jairus, I want to get back to this issue of medicine's involvement. In the early 1960s, the medical profession was very instrumental in the recognition of child abuse. I mean, there literally wasn't a category like that before, and some of it had to do with, I think a lot of it actually came out of Colorado, recognizing a syndrome, a pattern of injuries that seemed to fit together with abuse. Has something like that happened in the domestic violence also?
Yes. And as you note, the what we call child abuse is technically is non-accidental trauma, and it does typically have a pattern, and depending upon the, I guess, the positioning of the child to the person who is initiating the trauma, whether it's a shaking injury, whether it's someone who's grabbed and pulled suddenly, there are some characteristic patterns of injury that result from that that are fairly dramatic and help guide us in a workup and help us go from sort of a passive, we'll treat the injury, but we won't treat the mechanism. But it was about 20 years ago, ironically, about the same time that the Men's March began, when there was a major focus in the field of emergency medicine to increase recognition for victims of domestic violence. And whether it's those who are suffering emotional trauma, those suffering physical trauma, or both, there, again, are certain patterns of presentation. So we touched upon those briefly, and that's sometimes, you know, injuries inconsistent with the story, a very quiet victim who is less able to talk about injuries than what you would expect for someone with a degree of injury, someone who is withdrawn and relatively non-communicative, and somewhat anxious about their partner who may be in another room or particular in the waiting room. So these are important issues in terms of our recognition. And so a lot of our effort in the emergency medicine field these days is to help people realize that a little light bulb should go on, and then we should ask about how they feel in terms of their personal safety and remind them that this is a safe place to talk. And then just listen. Let them tell their story.
So let's – go ahead, Sal.
I want to go a step further on this also, bring in some things that Jairus was saying. There was a book written a bunch of years ago called Ghosts in the Nursery. And you were talking about – Jairus was mentioning about sometimes the injuries aren't visible. One of the statistics shows that when a female is pregnant, he'll punch her in the stomach because that's where he knows it's going to hurt her the most psychologically, physically. But when we talk, and a couple of people who have just talked to us from the Big Island, for example, talked about the effect on our children. Well, child abuse goes even further. The Ghost in the Nursery talks about the fetus. And I'm not a chemist and a biologist, so but I can give you a general idea. What they were saying was, certain parts of time during pregnancy, different parts of the brain are developing, and sometimes it's the part that is for the emotions, and other times it's the cognitive center. And if a woman is getting abused, and her body is sending all kinds of hormones through because of the abuse, then the part of the brain at that time that's the affect side is over developing because of this these chemicals, this hormone. All right, when that child is born, that child has a more difficult time, and this is statistically proven, to deal with his or her emotions. And so research then took people who had this background that were in jail and found a connection between violent crime, violent behavior as an adult, difficulties as an adolescent, and children who were abused inside as a fetus. So, and I guess the last word on this is for me is, if we really want, you know, we talk about world peace. If we want world peace, we need to have peace in our homes so that we don't pass this kind of violence on to our children and into our communities, into our country.
The number to call is 941-3689 on Oahu, and the neighbor islands, 1-877-941-3689. Peter, have you worked with the perpetrators or the accused?
Not so much with the accused, with the programs that I have. But I'd like to tag on one more comment to the last two comments with Dr. Hedges and Sal, and tie that into the last caller as well. The point about the victim not being the only one that's affected, whether it's the fetus in the womb or maybe the children in the household. You know, we're talking about legacies and it passing on. You know, they see that example. Maybe the kids aren't abused, but they're seeing, you know, mom get hit, and that becomes normal for them. So that legacy carries on. There's a lot more people affected than just the initial victim. I also wanted to make a comment. We're doing a lot of talking about this, but I wanted to give out some information really quickly about the Domestic Violence Action Center. If anyone has any issues that need addressing regarding domestic violence, their legal hotline is 808-531-3771. Again, that's 808-531-3771. That's for the Domestic Violence Action Center.
That's a very comprehensive operation, advocacy, all kinds of help, teamwork. So we know that bad relationships, we know that violence is learned behavior in the family, just as good child rearing is learned behavior. I noticed that the recent Violence Against Women's Act, some of the things that they encourage is kind of educational processes for families, prevention kind of thing about the best way to do. Do we do any of that sort of thing here? Are you involved in any of that?
We do have programs that address that at Catholic Charities. It's not part of my division, but we have counseling programs that deal with anger management and address a lot of these issues head on. You know, you'd ask if I deal with the perpetrators. No, not so much with my programs, but at Catholic Charities, we do have such programs.
I'd like to move in a second to some of the policy issues and also some of the ways that other agencies in town work, like the HPD, for example. But before I do that, I want to get more specific and personal for a second. Do any of you want to talk about some of your own personal experiences that you've had with domestic violence, either besides as a caregiver?
Well, go ahead. You go first.
Yeah, I'll lead and Sal can follow. You know, one of the things I've grappled with for a number of years was that my own father was a person who had serious anger management problems. So both my brother and I and my mother suffered from that. But I learned so much more about his situation as I got older, which I could not conceive of as a child. And so as Peter said, you know, the children are victimized by not understanding this, often thinking somehow it's their issue, they've created this. And so this is a family situation where the family needs help. My own father was a combat veteran in World War II, did not want to talk about the war, did not deal with that. He also had a serious health condition and had progressive heart failure developing over a number of years, which limited his physical activity and also led him to have an incredibly short temper. It wasn't actually until I entered medical school and got him a new heart valve, once I diagnosed the problem, that he actually changed his whole outlook on life and became a totally different person. So things are not always purely learned behavior. There's sometimes physical reasons behind what you see as well.
Did any of that affect your decision to go to medical school?
I think indirectly, yes.
Let's take some calls here. Paul from Kahalu. Go ahead, Paul. Welcome.
Yeah, I just had a comment that I thought there should be some outreach toward the perpetrators before everything gets out of control, instead of calling in law enforcement, if there was some way that people could reach out to somebody who reach out to the the perpetrators and put their hand on their forearm, so to speak. I myself was in an abusive relationship for a long time, and my ex-wife was quick to rattle the knife drawer. So it's a lot of emotion all tied up in a lot of investment in all these relationships that has to be kind of considered. And that's my comment.
Thank you.
I can't directly speak to specific programs other than maybe some of the mediation centers. Tying into personal experience, I can relate to the last caller. In my case, I did go through mediation and try to address things that way. However, there did become a time when I was a victim and when I had to call 911. And that brings up a whole another set of issues. People think about, well, a man was the victim of domestic violence. It happens. It happens. It's uncomfortable. It's hard to navigate through the legal process because in this case, I had a big red mark across my face. As soon as the police came, they threw me up against the wall and started questioning me, and I'm the one who made the call. So that's a whole flip side of things, too. Men are the victims of domestic violence from time to time, and it's not it doesn't seem normal and comfortable to navigate it. I'm sure it's not comfortable for women either, but the court systems are kind of set up in a way that the man is the guilty party before proven innocent.
Though the police aren't supposed to do that, but we'll come back to that in a little while. Let me take another call here. Anna from Wailuku. Welcome.
Hello. Yes. I'm a social worker, and we work with families that are pregnant and that have newborns, infants, and toddlers up to 3 years old. And I've been, so far this year, we've seen several families where, unfortunately, the father was being emotionally or physically inappropriate with the family. And the last recourse mom had was to place a TRO on the father. And in our court system here in Wailuku on Maui, the current family judge does not want to look at any evidence presented by the mother, and he's been granting overnight unsupervised stays for the children once the TRO is in place. And the children are coming back traumatized with having to go to the doctor because there was a cigarette burn on one child. And this particular family had testimony from third parties, and they had evidence and a lawyer. And when they went to court to address the TRO, the judge granted 3 overnight stays every week for this child. Regardless, and he threw out any evidence. He said he did not want to look at anything. And the mother believes that the father is doing this because he does not want to have to pay child support. And I think it's a crime because the children are regressing in their developmental skills, and the mothers are more worried than ever that for several nights a week their child is in this person's care that obviously has issues, and he needs help too. So I just wanted to bring that up.
Thanks,
Anna.
I know
there's several families that are going through it here on Maui.
I'm going to ask the panel to say something about the effectiveness of TROs. TROs are temporary restraining orders, and it's one of the ways that you initially can separate yourself from a relationship that you think is abused. Anybody here want to jump in and talk about how effective they are, when they work, when they don't work?
Go ahead, Jairus. You have.
I think there are different experiences with different people. In a variety of cities where I've practiced, I've found that temporary restraining orders are probably most helpful when there has been more verbal and no serious physical threat. once there have been serious physical threats, you probably need to have some significant separation of the parties, and a temporary restraining order may be insufficient.
But it's up to the police to enforce them, right? Or you may have to call the police, but they're the enforcement mechanisms of a TRO, right?
I think that that's what Peter alluded to earlier. You can enforce it. This is why we have safe houses here. Mm-hmm. Where people can basically live and hide. This is why, as Peter said earlier, someone came over from California to be here. People leave here to go to California because if the person is really violent and focused on an intent, then it's just a piece of paper.
Exactly. I mean, we've seen all too many times it's not a force field. If it's something severe like that, that's not its purpose.
Let's take another call here. Linda from Kona. Welcome, Linda. You still there? Lynn? Sandra from Maui. Sandra, welcome.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. First of all, thank you all for having this conversation. I'd like to ask the panel about their thoughts on the challenges of keeping the abused, be they men or women, safe on the islands with smaller populations. Obviously, if we're in Oahu, there's millions of people there, but in the smaller islands, I'm from Maui, people tend to know each other, and how do we deal with that in the opinion of the panel?
Peter, you want to start?
Yeah, that small island, it is an issue. It is a big issue because it's hard to get away, which is why, you know, the point of people leaving the state and actually, if they're able to, getting physically away. But I do understand. I mean, you either know the person, you're related to the person. It's very difficult when you're in a confined island setting. Absolutely.
There was a anthropologist who did a lot of research over here. She's written a lot about Hawaii and mainly on Hilo. Her name is Sally Mary, and she spent a lot of time studying abused women and so on. And the expression that she would use to describe it is that women have rights, and part of what these programs would be is to try to teach them what their rights are. But she said they would use rights the way you would try on a dress. They would try on these rights to see if they worked under the circumstances. And one of the circumstances that was really key was this whole thing about the friends and the family. And again, Hilo is, I mean, yeah, it's a small place too. Any comments about that?
Yeah, I think the Domestic Violence Action Center, I think they have a number somewhere of safety plans that they help people put together. And I can remember way back working with Nancy on a project where they were helping people know how to develop safety plans. And so, you know, the kind of thing where you put some clothing of you and your children someplace not at home. You put some money someplace not at, so that if you have to leave, you're not out in the street. You can get to the big. You can leave Maui and get someplace else, and start to take care of yourself. If in fact the whole island is not a safe place, I think the important thing is if someone really feels that they're in a long-term abusive relationship and the place is not safe, the first thing is get safe, and then you can start, you know, dealing with resources and et cetera.
To add to that, I have some statistics about the Domestic Violence Action Center. In the last 16 years, they've helped to create 52,927 safety plans.
That's not only a lot of plans, it shows how big the problem is.
Yes.
Let's take a call from Linda from Kona. Go ahead, Linda.
Hi. Thank you, everyone, for your wonderful content. I want to say that are you familiar with transforming our communities with the organization Seeds of Peace? That's CEEDS. They're working with training school teachers to teach the children. We can get a level of violence and have new social mores in our communities that will help transform all of our lives more peaceful.
Linda, you're fading out a little bit, but why don't you very quickly tell us who's doing this program and where it's being done? I'm sorry, we're losing you. You can try again to call back if you want.
If I may, the concept is a Buddhist concept, Seeds of Peace. And it's, in fact, there's a book I'm reading right now from from a professor at UH who wrote it, Seeds of Peace, and from Thailand. But the idea is we all have seeds of violence in us. We all have seeds of peace in us. And the important thing is, how do we help our children, ourselves, our families, cultivate and water the seeds of peace that are in us, and not so much the others. And I know there are programs out there doing that, and we'd be interested in hearing about them.
I just want to add one other thing, that you can get more information on the website called Hawaii Says No More. For additional programs, there's lots of programs that are tied in with the march on October. You'll find some of this on Everbright, I'm sure, but if you want to check in. Anybody else want to say anything?
Yeah, I'd like to tag on to that. And I guess we're kind of looking at the youth right now, and that's a big part of our march as well. We get a lot of participants through the high schools, the local high schools. Domestic Violence Action Center actually goes out and does outreach to the public schools and some of the private schools as well. Talk about planting the seeds. Domestic violence, unfortunately, can start, in your teenage years and they're dating for the first time and all of a sudden these things come up. So there is outreach that goes out to the schools. And back to our march again, we've had participation from a lot of the private schools, the public schools. Last year we had one of the public schools, go ahead and name Farrington actually sent out a bunch of kids from their health class because it's definitely a health issue. We had, I think, at least 40 kids that came out. So really, that's who we're trying to reach out to as well and help to have the awareness out there even at a younger age so it doesn't perpetuate.
I have more information on Seeds of Peace. It's CEEDS, and it's started by President Obama's sister, Maya, who is an education professor here. And very much involved in peace education and so on. I'd like to talk a little bit about culture. Some of the arguments that I've heard over the years is that the model that has been used predominantly in the area of domestic abuse, this power and control model it's caused, essentially started in northern Minnesota at the University of Minnesota Duluth and has been spread all over the world. And people have raised sort of cultural issues, not to say that the model is wrong, but to say, how do you adjust a particular model that's kind of generic to a particular place that's there? And I guess I want to put that question in a little more specific sort of way. Do you get the kind of cultural arguments when you're dealing with the perpetrator of abuse or even the abusers that say, we do things differently in our culture? And how do you respond to that? What do you do?
Well, that happens periodically in the emergency department, but we uphold the laws of our state, and we do not accept that as an argument that would, win the day. So if a woman complains, or a man for that matter, of being the victim of abuse, we address that. And generally, in the post-event sort of counseling mode, one can begin to address some of the underlying cultural aspects. But in the initial reaction, though, you just don't accept that and then change course. We provide the protection and the safety.
We have a call from Keone. Keone, go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, hi. I guess my comment is sort of a question as well, but I've just been listening to the program for a while now today, and it's an interesting topic. I mean, my main question/comment is, what's the penetration percentage of these cases actually being resolved in a positive manner? I mean, there's just so much to take into account. I mean, going to TROs that you guys were speaking about earlier, anybody can file a TRO against anybody, and the person that is being filed against, they will probably be served by a process server at work or something, and that, creates its own drama to begin with. But that person cannot speak or have any contact with the person who filed it, and if they do, it's a misdemeanor. I mean, whether or not there's any sort of substance to what the TRO was, you know, adhering to in the first place, and I think that, personally, I think that that is being abused, first off. But then again, at the same time, we have a lot of actual domestic violence occurring, whether it be the male as a perpetrator or vice versa, emotional or physical. You know, there's just so many questions that are just, in my opinion, left unanswered because the judicial system, I mean, you have these caseworkers working on this, you know, whether it's before or after court or during court. In my opinion, these people are probably not paid enough, so you better hope that they love what they do, and I think it's safe to assume that most of them don't absolutely have a passion for what they're doing based on their pay, and, you know, that's a whole separate issue on its own. But, I mean, I guess long story short is that this is a problem in the home, so it's almost like every case needs to be taken on a case-to-case basis. But is there towards the person that is originally filing this complaint and deeming themselves as, you know, the person that's, you know, the victim, so to speak? I mean,
thanks, Keone. Let's people have some comments about that.
I do, actually. I'd like to. I think one of the things that he was asking about is resolution. Is there ever a positive resolution? And I'd like to point out something positive about the courts. My experience is I don't know if the program continues, but there was something called Kids First. And I'd like to point out specifically Judge Karen Radius, who was dealing with that in my experiences.
I think it continues understaffed,
yeah.
But
it's, you know, it's fantastic for, especially for those cases that can be kind of dialed back down and address what's really important, the kids first, and then let's try to move forward. And that program is really good for refocusing and kind of taking the anger out and putting the focus on those kids. And in my case, positive resolutions.
It's a complicated question, right? Because sometimes reconciliation is the satisfactory answer. Sometimes separation is, and sometimes it's a process that involves both over time. So
yeah,
what makes it more complicated.
And if I may, Sal, this is also a real political issue, and I'm concerned about it personally. And that is, in the last maybe 5-10 years, in the last 5 or 10 years, there was a real push for reconciliation politically to keep the family together, and a result of that here were a few child deaths. So reconciliation is not always the answer. And yes, we have to go one at a time. But I would rather someone err in the side of safety for the children and safety for the abused than have a political agenda that says, let's keep the family together at all costs.
Last question. In regard to that, I'll give it to you, Peter. Is that what public policy is now here, that it leans in the direction of being skeptical of reconciliation?
I'm not being skeptical.
I'm sorry. I don't know how to answer that. I do think that that's a really important point, though. I mean, because, again, personal experience, our best solution was to separate.
I want to thank all three of the panelists for participating in this. It was a very fast hour. I enjoyed it. I learned a good deal about it. I just want to say two things. One is that to remind you about the Men's March Against Violence, October 8th at noon down at the Capitol. Next week's show I'll be hosting again. It's with Jim Dooley, the longtime investigative reporter and the author of the new book, Sunny Skies, Shady Characters, which is his memoir about political corruption in Hawaii. Thanks again, everybody.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Have a good evening, everyone.